Welcome to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now your host, Jared Serbu.
5 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Thanks for being with us for another edition of On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. This week we're spending the hour on military compensation. Study after study has examined the ways in which and the levels at which we offer pay and benefits to members of the uniformed services, and most have concluded that what the country is doing now can't be sustained. The last two Secretaries of Defense in particular have publicly groused about the fact that compensation costs are gradually eating up a greater and greater share of the overall defense budget pie. If no changes are made, the rate at which compensation costs are growing will leave no money for anything else in DoD within just the next few decades. Congress has made some changes over the past years to the military compensation system, but they've mostly been to add benefits, not to bring costs under control. And over the past few budget cycles, the extent of the compensation debate on Capitol Hill has been whether military retirees should pay more or less for a health care plan that currently costs them about $520 per year. Today we're going to chew on a lot of other military compensation issues, though, and Todd Harrison has given us plenty to chew on in a new study. He is the Senior Fellow for Defense Budget Studies here at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, where he's just published Rebalancing Military Compensation, an Evidence-Based Approach, and he is our guest for this hour. Todd, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So I mentioned in the introduction, you know, the myriad of studies of military compensation going back decades. Most of them offered up recommendations for bringing costs in line with what's necessary to sustain that all-volunteer force. We should say from the outset, your study does not offer a prescription for fixing this problem. We'll get into the details of the study itself as we go on, but briefly, just for starters, tell me about your approach to this issue and why you took the route that you did.
Well, you know, like you said in the introduction there, you know, the military compensation system in its current form is unsustainable because costs are growing so rapidly. Just from 2001 to 2011, the cost per person in the uniformed military grew by 46%, and that's even adjusting for inflation and not including additional war-related funding.
I was going to say, because the rejoinder to that is always, well, we were in a time of war. It's
yeah,
not
but
necessarily
this is
related to that.
Just in the base budget, not even including the additional pays because of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, 46% real growth over that decade. If we were to continue that in the future and the overall defense budget remains flat, by the year 2039, the entire defense budget would be consumed by military personnel costs. We'd have no money for any kind of equipment, training, readiness, nothing. We wouldn't even have money for bases. We would just be able to send paychecks out to people. Of course, that'll never happen. What will happen is that as personnel costs continue to grow, we will have to downsize the overall size of the military. We'll have to cut military in strength. We're already seeing that start to happen. Right now, as budgets are flat, basically projected flat over the rest of the decade or dropping about 10% if sequestration happens, we're already seeing that we're going to lose 100,000, 200,000 troops just because of that flattening of growth. That's something that you cannot allow to continue forever. But the other thing we wanted to look at in the study is the actual composition of military pay and benefits. And so that's when we started by just going back to 1970, actually. And back then, President Nixon appointed a commission known as the Gates Commission, and they were charged with looking at whether or not it was feasible to end the draft and transition to an all-volunteer force. And former Secretary of Defense Gates, who led the commission, he started out from the position that he didn't think it was feasible, that he thought we would need to keep the draft. But over the course of the commission's work, he came around to the notion that, yeah, we can have an all-volunteer force. But as they noted in their report, there would have to be some fundamental changes to our military compensation system for an all-volunteer force to be workable. The key difference that they pointed out at the time is that, you know, it's not that transitioning to an all-volunteer force is something new. We've always had a volunteer force, but not an all-volunteer force. What we've had is a volunteer force, a core group of people, professionals in the military, almost all of which were career-oriented people. And then we've supplemented those people with conscripts, draftees, in time of war when we needed to surge.
In fact, in Vietnam in particular, a huge proportion of volunteers even serving there in what's, I think, thought of by many people as a conscription war.
Yeah, exactly. Even at the height of the Vietnam War in 1968, 1969, the majority of people serving in the military were true volunteers, not draftees and not draft-induced volunteers, because there are a number of those too. But true volunteers volunteers were a majority of the military even then. So what they basically said was, look, you're going from the system where they volunteer military supplemented by conscripts. The volunteers are almost all career people. You've designed the compensation system to attract and retain career people. If you're going to go to an all-volunteer military, you have to also have a compensation system that is attractive to short-term non-career volunteers. The kinds of pays and benefits that appeal to short-term people are very different than the kinds of benefits that appeal to long-term career people. For example, retirement benefits in the military. The military back then had a 20-year retirement system. You serve 20 years, you can get 50% of your pay for the rest of your life. We have basically the same retirement system today. It hasn't changed. That offers basically no incentive for short-term people, people who only intend to join and serve, you know, 4 or 5 years. And by the way, even today, more than half of the military serves 5 years or less. So we still have basically the same compensation system that we had before we transitioned to an all-volunteer force today. And, you know, the Gates Commission pointed out a number of things that needed to change. And it wasn't just benefits. It was also things like basic pay, and non-compensation related things as well, perhaps not requiring people to re-enlist for a fixed amount of time, giving them more flexibility, mm-hmm. Not requiring people to move as often, things like that, giving people greater choice of, you know, what they do in their career in the military. All of these factors, they thought, would be more attractive to the short-term non-career volunteers that were going to be essential to make an all-volunteer force workable.
So out of that Gates Commission report that as you said, was instrumental in ending the draft and transitioning to the all-volunteer force, how many recommendations did we actually end up implementing and how many sat on the shelf?
Yeah, so the best I can tell of the dozen or so recommendations that came out of that report, only one actually got enacted, and that was increasing basic pay for the junior-most personnel. So, you know, during the draft in Vietnam, E1s and E2s, the most junior ranks in the military, that's if you were drafted, that's what you came into. You're an E1 and then an E2. We didn't have to pay them hardly anything because they didn't have a choice but to be there. So they were paid pennies, compared to what, would have been a fair compensation at the time. So as of January 1st, 1972, Congress went ahead and doubled the pay for E1s and E2s. They literally doubled their pay overnight. And that was the biggest change that came out of what the Gates Commission recommended. The end of the draft did happen in 1973. I think it was in July of 1973 is when the draft officially ended. But all of the things the Gates Commission said that you needed to do other than, increasing the basic pay for junior enlisted, Congress just, put them on the shelf and said, well, that's interesting. We'll think about it. And we've debated, and there's been dozens of studies, literally, year after year. In the 4 decades since then, we've just, debated this over and over again, and we've never actually tried to fix the problem of what do we need to do to change our military compensation system to really work for an all-volunteer force.
Well, and what is the problem? Because at least at the moment, the problem is not attracting and retaining service members. Every service is meeting their retention and accession goals every single quarter.
Right.
What is the problem right now as you see it?
Well, the problem right now is cost. Mm-hmm. Is that the costs are growing faster than we can sustain. And it's going to cause us to have to cut modernization and cut in strength and possibly even cut readiness just to pay for these personnel costs. That's the problem right now. It wasn't that long ago, though, that we were having problems with recruiting and retention. Back in 2005, 2006, the Army was having real problems. They were not meeting their recruiting goals. It was a very tough environment. That was when the Iraq War was not going very well. The economy, was still going strong at that time. And so it was hard for the military to compete to get people. So they had to relax some standards. They had to take people they normally in most years would not have taken into the military. They had to promote people in the military that in normal years would not have been promoted. And, that's something that you don't want your military to be in that situation. So when the economy is bad, it's actually good for military recruiting and retention. I think that's part of the reason we're at such a good place right now. But we could be at a point in the future where, you know, the economy picks back up, jobs are growing, people have other options, and then you've got to be competitive. If you're the military, it's not just, you know, offering more of everything. You've got to offer the right mix of pay and benefits if you're going to make sure you can attract and retain the best and the brightest.
Right. So where we are right now, you're saying, is kind of an anomaly just because of the economy. But
We're in a good situation right now, but I think the economy is really the driver behind that. It's a twin issue. It's the cost and it's recruiting and retention. We're okay on recruiting and retention right now because of the economy. The costs are hurting us, though. As the later Secretary of Defense Gates has said, these costs are eating the budget alive.
Right.
So that's something we've got to deal with. I think that's the driver right now for reform of the compensation system is the cost. But it won't be long, I think, in the future before it's recruiting and retention as well as cost.
Well, and another anomaly maybe over the past 10 years is even as these costs have grown, as you said, 48% over the past decade, even when you exclude the cost of actually being at war, we were in an environment where the overall pie could expand at the same time the personnel costs were expanding. We're not in that spot anymore.
Exactly. And, you know, we were, you know, the defense budget grew leaps and bounds over the past decade. And so it was easy to add, you know, new benefits, to expand existing benefits, to give pay raises that were above the recommended level, above the rate of pay raises in the, you know, overall economy. It was easy to add all of these things on, and it was part of, hey, let's support the troops. It's easy to do that when the budget's growing and you don't have a huge deficit problem. But things are different now, and there's a lot of belt tightening going on. And, you know, we're really in a zero-sum game here that if you grow military personnel costs, you're going to have to cut something else in the budget. Not all the elements of the budget can grow now. Something's got to be cut. That's just the reality that we live in.
And, of course, the easiest way or the most straightforward way to cut down on military personnel costs is to just reduce the overall end strength of the military services, which, as you said, some of that's happening now, but you can only take that too far.
Yeah, if you don't change the underlying cause of the growth, then what you'll end up with is a situation where you have to keep cutting end strength as your personnel costs continue to grow year after year. At some point in the future, you're going to end up with a force that's so small it won't be effective for even the most basic military operations.
We're going to take our first break here. Come back in just a moment with Todd Harrison from the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. We're talking about the military compensation system, how to design one that might better align with what the military actually needs in order to recruit and retain the all-volunteer force that it wants. Back in just a minute. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbe. Thanks for listening to Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We are back. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu, talking this week about military compensation with Todd Harrison from the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He's just finished a study that looks at some of the elements of military compensation and what service members most value, which might be a little bit of a help to lawmakers as they pursue reforms in this area. We'll get to some of those details in a little bit, but Todd, first I want to go back to a little bit of the history in this area because it is rich. There are enough studies on military compensation that have been done over the past 40 years to fill up this room, and then some, I am sure. We were talking a little bit about the Gates Commission that began the military's planning process for ending the draft and switching to the all-volunteer force in the last segment. Talk to me about one of their recommendations, which was changing the vesting time for military retirement. That never actually happened, but what did they want to do?
Well, so what they recommended was, you know, since you're an all-volunteer force, you've got to focus on getting a compensation system that will attract and retain short-term volunteers. The 20-year retirement system really doesn't do anything for them. So they recommended shortening the vesting period for the retirement system. So you would get a partial retirement as early as 5 years, with just 5 years of service. And that was interesting because, you know, not only did we not do that, if you fast forward to the 1980s, Congress, the last time we had a big deficit problem and Congress was looking at ways to save money and cut the defense budget, one of the things they came up with was a change to the retirement system. And they said, hey, we could save lots of money if we basically stretch out the retirement vesting. So instead of getting 50% of your pay after 20 years of service, you'd only get 40%. But then it would ramp up, and after 30 years of service, you would get 75% of your pay, which is the same as it was under the old system. What that did, in effect, was it stretched out the vesting period, so you had to serve longer to get more of the retirement benefits, which is the exact opposite of what the Gates Commission had recommended. So they made a change to save money that encouraged, it basically rewarded people for staying longer than 20 years. The Gates Commission said, no, you need a retirement system that rewards people for staying less than 20 years. We need the short-term volunteers. You know, that's a good example of where we've, you know, made a change, a fundamental change in the compensation system, and it's gone in the exact opposite direction.
And it eventually got repealed because once it was time for some of these changes to actually kick in, there was objection from, among others, some of the senior military brass.
Yeah, so, you know, this was known as Redux, mm-hmm. which, you know, basically is short for reduction because it just reduced the retirement benefits, how generous they were. Well, around 1999, 2000, when we were getting a little closer to that point when it would actually happen, then you started to hear grumblings in the Pentagon from all the services. A good example I point out in my paper, and this is, gets to the heart of why we wanted to do the study the way that we did, Representative John Murtha, the late congressman, yes. He was one of the big champions in Congress for overturning Redux. And he talked about this at length, about why he came around and thought that this was a bad idea. And it actually stems from a ad hoc conversation he had with a group of folks aboard an aircraft carrier. And based on that anecdotal evidence of people telling him, this is the single most important thing you could do to improve recruiting and retention in the military is overturning Redux, he led the charge to overturn it and ultimately was successful in overturning it. But I look at something like that and I scratch my head and say, wait a second, maybe it was the right decision, but should it have been based on anecdotal evidence? Yeah. Just a handful of people he happened to talk to on an aircraft carrier, which probably were overwhelmingly officers, long-term career officers who were going to be directly impacted by Redux? Or should we look more broadly, more scientifically at this and try to, you know, get real evidence based on the preferences of those who serve about what type of retirement benefits would, you know, you value the most relative to other types of benefits?
We're going to switch in the next segment to some of the issues in your report as you try and walk us through what different values military members place on different forms of compensation. But spend the next couple minutes with me, if you would, describing a little bit more about where we are today. What are the main drivers of the increases in compensation costs that we're seeing right now that are beginning to crowd out other areas?
Well, one of the biggest drivers over the past decade has actually been military health care. And I divide this up in basically three ways. There's military health care that goes for active duty service members and their dependents. They receive that health care free of charge. There's no annual premium. And if they get their, health care services on base, there's usually no charge, or little to no charge for that. If you go off base, you would have to pay a slight copay. So that, you know, that's a big part of it. And what we're finding, the growth that we're seeing there is because we're seeing more people go off base for their care. That's a little more expensive. The kind of middle area of military health care is military retirees and their dependents under the age of 65. So they're not people who are eligible for Medicare yet. What's happened there is they do have to pay an annual premium. It was set in 1995 at $460 a year, $38 a month for a family plan. It covers you and all of your dependents. That premium did not increase 1 cent until 2011. So all of that time period, healthcare costs in the private economy were growing leaps over bounds, 5-10% a year growth in healthcare costs. So what happened is military retirees, about 70% of them actually work or have a spouse at work. So they have another healthcare option in the private sector. But instead of taking healthcare through their private sector employer, they're opting in greater numbers to stay in the military healthcare system. And of course, when they stay in the military healthcare system, they're paying such a low premium, the vast majority of the cost is borne by the military. It comes right out of the DOD budget. And we're talking military retirees here. Veterans is separate. Veterans health care is a separate issue altogether. So we saw a dramatic growth in the number of military retirees that were staying in the military health care system, and so cost growth because of that. But then also a new form of coverage was created back in 2001 It's known as TRICARE for Life, and that is a supplemental Medicare insurance policy. So it's basically a wraparound policy for Medicare that pays almost all the costs that Medicare doesn't pay. That applies to military retirees, so those who've served 20 years or more and retired, only once they turn 65 and go on Medicare. So you think it would be a relatively small number of people, and it is a relatively small number of people that actually qualify for that, but it's incredibly expensive to provide. It was a brand new benefit added in 2001, and it is now costing the Department of Defense almost $11 billion a year. We went from nothing for TRICARE for Life to $11 billion a year. And right now, DOD has to set aside $5,500 for every single person who serves in the active duty military. They have to set that aside in a trust fund to pay for the future benefits of the very small number of people who will one day draw TRICARE for Life, because fewer than 20% of the military actually stays to retirement, and not all of those people will make it to 65.
Right. And, you know, just to underscore the huge role that healthcare plays in this military compensation area, there are various groups that do top 10, top 20 lists of military contractors. And there are three contractors that serve the entire TRICARE system. All three of those are now in the top 15 of military, maybe top 20, but at least top 20. You know, they're alongside Lockheed, alongside Northrop Grumman. That's how big healthcare costs have gotten in the system.
It is big business for DOD.
And so we'll get into some more of your recommendations, or not recommendations, but some of your analysis of what military members value in terms of their compensation. But to stick with healthcare, what can you do in that area? What are your options other than scaling back the benefits and increasing the out-of-pocket costs to beneficiaries?
Yeah, well, you've got to change the incentive somehow. You know, the TRICARE for Life, it's a new benefit. Once you've added a new benefit, it's hard to take it back. What you could do with TRICARE for Life is right now it's free. You could start charging a premium for that. And that's something that was proposed by the Obama administration in the current budget request, although it seems to be dead on the Capitol Hill. So you could charge a fee for that. I don't think you'll ever be able to take it back completely once you promised it to people. For TRICARE for military retirees under the age of 65, well, they've tried to raise that premium, and it looks like that's going to stall on Capitol Hill again. But fundamentally, what you want to do there to really save cost is drive people out of the system. I know that sounds crude, but when people have other options for insurance through their private employer, you want to incentivize them to take that option instead of staying in the military healthcare system wherever possible. You can do that by raising the premium. You could do it by raising copays, by limiting, you know, the number of doctors, things like that. You know, none of those are going to be viewed favorably by military retirees, of course. But, you know, those are some of the things you can do to just bring down the cost. The other thing, of course, is just trying to drive down the cost of healthcare.
Right. Which is a national problem.
That's a national problem. And, you know, we had the solution to that. Well, you know, we could fix everything. You know, one of the things people often don't realize, too, is that the rate at which TRICARE pays doctors, the doctor reimbursement rate under TRICARE, is set by law to be the same as the Medicare reimbursement rate. So when we do things like, you know, the Affordable Care Act to try to reduce costs for Medicare reimbursements to doctors, that actually also reduces TRICARE costs. So there's kind of a double benefit there.
And I think you've seen some of that already. DOD recently issued a reprogramming request to Congress in which they said, we actually haven't spent all of everything that we budgeted for TRICARE this year. We'd like to use it elsewhere. So maybe some of that is actually kicking in.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what that's due to. I know that they have a hard time projecting what the costs are going to be. And so I think that's part of it, is they just didn't anticipate as well as they maybe could have what the costs were actually going to be. But they did have a temporary surplus in that account. Now they're, you know, trying to reprogram it to use it somewhere else in the department. But to put it in perspective, you know, it just means that they were off by, you know, 1 or 2%.
Yeah.
Now, 1 or 2% of a large number is still a large number. But, you know, they, you know, I wouldn't count on, you know, those kind of savings materializing year after year in the future.
Sure. Last thing before we break here, when you're designing a military compensation system, you know, is it just about attracting the people you need, recruiting and retaining and assessing the people that you need to serve in a force? Or is there something different about it than the way you would treat those kinds of things in a private economy? I mean, do we want to make this just market-based?
Yeah, I don't think you should make it just market-based. I think you need to step back and look at the evidence and look at where you're getting the most value out of your compensation system. Where are you getting the least value? Where are the forms of compensation that people just don't appreciate or just don't like or don't use? You know, you want to take all of that into account. But at the end of the day, it is your military, and that is different than, you know, just people who work at an ordinary company. And so I think there have to be some policy imperatives, if you will, things where you say, you know what, we're going to offer this benefit because we want them to have it even if they don't value it. And a good example I would give is the health care we provide for active duty service members. The nation has an interest in their health. We need them to be healthy so they can protect our nation. So even if people in the military don't value their own health care that they're getting, we should still give it to them because we need a healthy military that can go out there, you know, and fight the wars that we need and not be sick. You know, if you look back at history, you know, you go back, you know, World War I and earlier, you know, illness on the battlefield was a major source of casualties. We've come a long way since then. We don't want to go back. You know, I want everyone in the military to get their flu shot every year, you know, and we should be willing as a nation to pay for it, even if they don't want it.
Todd Harrison is our guest this week on DOD. He's Senior Defense Fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He's just finished a study called Rebalancing Military Compensation, which really might be the first look at what service members actually value in the military compensation system and how DOD and Congress might use that information and expand on that information to decide how to redesign the compensation system. Back in just a minute, this is on DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. We are back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is on DOD. I'm Jared Serbu. Thanks for listening this week. And we're talking with Todd Harrison from the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments about the military compensation system. He's just finished a study looking at what military members actually value when you look across the spectrum of how they are offered pay and benefits through the military services. And Todd, we were talking off the air. There was a major report released by the Center for Strategic and International Studies just down the street here in the think tank district of D.C. And I remember one of their report basically just outlined the scale of the problem and put it in pretty stark terms. And I remember some of the contributors saying at the time it would be really great if we had some kind of metrics to see, you know, what service members want, what they undervalue, what they overvalue in terms of what they get out of the military compensation system. And it looks like your study is probably the first attempt to actually do that. So talk me through why you decided to do that and some of what you found.
Well, so it actually started when I ran into some guys from a company called True Choice Solutions, and they do preference analytics, is what they call it, for a lot of Fortune 500 companies. And they showed me the tool that they had where they go in and they go through and they ask people, how do you value different forms of compensation? You know, and you know, companies they've done this for, it might be how do you value, you know, salary versus, you know, benefits like a company car or a dental plan or regular health insurance. And they started showing me this, and I said, you know what? Someone needs to do this for DOD. We really need to do this for DOD and show how you can measure quantitatively how people value different forms of benefits, different levels of those benefits, and how they make trade-offs between them. Rather than guessing at it, rather than using, you know, economic models or you know, best practices from other organizations, you could go out and directly measure this from service members and hear from them directly how do they value these things. And more importantly, if you get a good, you know, spectrum of people taking the survey, you can then subdivide it and say, well, how do people, you know, junior enlisted value these things different than senior officers? How do people with less than 5 years time in service value things differently than people with 20 or more years of service? So you could start to sort out what are those actual differences, and some of the types of compensation that we offer that we think are attractive to a certain segment of the military, maybe they are, maybe it isn't. We could actually go out and test it and see how they value these things.
And I guess the fundamental question there, as far as a cost perspective comes into play, is are we spending a lot of money on things that people don't value or care about that much?
Yeah, so the example True Choice gave me when we were talking about this originally is they said, well, they find that when they go out to a lot of private employers and ask people, you know, well, how do you value a dental plan? It may cost the company, say, $1,000 a year to provide dental insurance for their employees, but their employees might only value it the equivalent of a $500 pay increase. So they would trade a $500 pay increase and give up the $1,000 dental coverage because they don't value the dental coverage properly. They said there's other forms of benefits they find that people tend to overvalue, like a company car. It may cost a company $300 a month to lease a car, but the employee may value it as much as $1,000 of pay. Maybe there's some status involved in that or whatever, intangible factors going on there. But if they value it more than it's worth, it's a great benefit. You want to definitely provide something like that. And so, the central idea here is if we go out and measure people's preferences and the way they value different forms of compensation, then we can tease out from the data which are the benefits that are undervalued, things that people don't value as much as they cost to provide, and what are the benefits that are overvalued or maybe properly valued, things that they get full value out of. And then, hence the name of the study, it's rebalancing military compensation. You want to move your resources from undervalued forms of compensation and reinvest them in more highly valued forms of compensation. And in the process, what you can do is not only save money because you won't need to reinvest all of the resources. You could still save some of that money, but you could also improve the value for people in the military. So it's a win-win situation. If you have the data, you can actually save money and come up with a compensation system that people prefer.
Right. So when you did this survey, were there things that jumped out at you? Were there things that we were spending money on that people undervalue, and were there things that we're spending money on that people overvalue?
Well, yeah. So the first thing we found is, and this was not too surprising, but basic pay was highly valued. People like their basic pay more than just about any other type of benefit. What was interesting, though, is if you look at how they value increases in basic pay, junior enlisted will value every dollar of increase in basic pay about six times as much as senior officers. So you get more bang for your buck by giving a pay raise to the junior guys than to the senior officers. And this is consistent with the theory of diminishing marginal utility in economics, whereas the more of a resource you have, each additional unit that you get, you don't value quite as much. So that's to be expected, but we were able to quantify it. But then if you look at, other benefits like, what's a good example, healthcare, TRICARE for Life, and that's one where we, subdivided it and looked at how people at different points in their career value that benefit, you would expect those with 20 or more years of service, people who have, already, qualified for retirement benefits, who are almost, virtually certain to receive this TRICARE for Life benefit in the future, they don't even value it as much as it costs DOD to provide. So you look at that and you say, well, that appears to be an undervalued form of compensation. So there are, a number of examples like that that we found where DOD could actually be doing better if they just moved resources from one type of compensation to another.
And with respect to healthcare in particular, I wonder, this I don't think is really addressed in your report, but I wonder if part of that is if you spend 20 years in the military and then retire and go on to TRICARE, you've never really been exposed to the true cost of what healthcare actually costs in the private economy. Is that a possible explanation for that undervaluing?
That could be part of it, that they don't understand. And also, I've found, talking with people in the military, that sometimes they don't know that the benefit exists. There are so many different types of military pays and benefits. Literally dozens, and we couldn't test them all in our survey, unfortunately, that not everyone even realizes what they have and what TRICARE for Life is, that it's a Medicare supplemental policy. It's not something that's easily explained in a few minutes. So if you don't know what a benefit is, or you don't know what it's actually worth, you're just not getting value for it. Whether it's an education problem that people don't know about it or what, the bottom line is DOD's not getting good value out of it, so why are they putting money into that?
Other big one, you mentioned basic pay and health care. The other big expense, I guess you would say, is retirement. What did you find there?
Yeah, the retirement system was interesting. So one of the things we asked was, what if we change the number of years of service required to get retirement benefits? Right now it's 20 years. We asked, well, what if you reduce it to 15? What if you raise it to 25 or raise it to 30? And what we found there was a little surprising, that you would think lowering it to 15 years of service, that makes it a more generous, a more expensive benefit. You would think people would prefer that. They don't. At all age groups, at all rank groups, no matter how you slice the data.
Including the very junior guys.
Including the very junior guys, they still prefer the 20-year retirement system over the 15-year retirement system. So, you know, I can't explain why. You know, the data doesn't tell us why. It just tells us what they say, what they're valuing, what their preferences are. But this is one of those areas where I would not try to improve the benefit by reducing it to 15 years of service. I would leave it right where it is at 20 years.
That's interesting. I'm going to completely speculate here and just say, maybe if you're one of those junior guys and you're 19 years old, you're not thinking that much about retirement yet, and basic pay is really more in your mind.
Yeah, well, if you look at it, just the way they rank different types of benefits relative to one another, the junior guys are very different than all other groups, than senior enlisted, junior officers, or senior officers. The junior guys value basic pay the most by far. All the retirement benefits and the health care benefits that you get in retirement, they aren't a high priority. They're a lower relative importance to the junior enlisted guys. They're really about the upfront pay.
Sticking with pay for a minute, there's this idea that's been kicked around in many of the studies, the idea of pay for performance, which is kind of a hot topic across federal government right now. What'd you learn there?
That was interesting. So I you know, going into the survey, you know, I freely admit I came in with all of my own biases, and I was biased towards this this performance-based pay.
It's a very wonky idea.
I thought, you know, this is a good idea, and I thought people in the military would love it. I mean, you know, I served in the Air Force Reserves, and, you know, so I'm pretty familiar with military culture, and I thought, you know, people in the military tend to be high performers. They tend to be go-getters, and they would want to be paid based on their performance, because they know that they could distinguish themselves. But what we found is that people at all different rank groups, all different ages, they do not value performance-based pay. Now, the junior guys tend to value it a little more than the senior guys, but when you get up to people that are in their 50s or so, they actually view it as a negative form of compensation. So if you offer them a 5, 10, 15% annual bonus based on performance, they actually view that equivalent to a pay cut.
Huh.
So it'd be a very bad idea to do for that group of people. But even for the junior guys that value it the most, you know, the 18, 19, 20-year-old, you know, people in their 20s, they don't value it as much as it would cost you to provide that kind of a performance-based pay. So despite the fact that I thought it seemed like a good idea and, you know, that I thought people would value it, they just don't. So I think it would actually, looking at the data, I think it would be a terrible idea.
Interesting. So, and there are other benefits, too, that proportionally cost the department a lot less, things like commissaries and exchanges and those kinds of ancillary benefits. Is there much savings to be gained by changing those, and how do military members feel about those kinds of benefits?
This is another one that really surprised me, and I'll freely admit my bias going into this. You know, when I was in the Air Force Reserves, I had commissary privileges. I never once set foot in a commissary. And so that benefit to me was worth zero because I never used it once. And so I tended to think, you know, oh, well, rational economic theory here says that rather than providing a $1.4 billion a year subsidy for the commissaries, and that's what they cost, you know, because we're selling groceries at below market rates to members of the military and their families and retirees, rather than putting that money into a chain of grocery stores, we should just take some fraction of that and just give people the cash. And then they can choose where they spend their money. And they should get more utility out of that because you have the flexibility. You don't have to buy milk to get the benefit. You can buy whatever you want. Well, we looked at it in the survey, and it's not so clear cut. You know, people in the military do value the commissaries. About a third of officers value them at about what they would cost to provide or how much you would save if you went to the system I talked about where you give people just a cash subsidy instead. So it's not so clear cut. With the exchanges, the military exchanges, and for people who aren't familiar with them, they're basically like a Walmart or a Target that's run, you know, by the military on a military base. They have very nice stores all over the country, different bases and posts throughout the country and around the world. People actually value the exchanges more than they cost to provide. Now, DOD doesn't provide a direct subsidy for the exchanges like they do with the commissaries, but they do provide some in-kind services for the exchange system. And so they end up costing DOD about $250 million a year. But you divide that out among everyone in the military, it's about $110 per person. And people tend to value that. A majority of service members in each rank group that we looked at value it more than it's actually costing to provide. So even though, you know, on a kind of a principled level, I question why the military is in the business of operating retail stores, I look at this and I say, well, that actually is a pretty effective, form of compensation. So, you know, you could still do things to reform the exchange system to make them operate more efficiently, but I would not change the essential benefit that it provides.
Todd Harrison is the author of Rebalancing Military Compensation, an Evidence-Based Approach. A lot more findings that we will link to at federalnewsradio.com, where you can go look at this report yourself. We're going to take one final break, come back, and talk about some takeaways from this report with Todd Harrison from the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. I'm Jared Serbu. This is On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We are back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is On DOD. I'm Jared Serbu, continuing our focus this hour on military compensation, how to better align it with what service members actually value. Todd Harrison from the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments has been looking into that issue. He's just published a paper called Rebalancing Military Compensation, an Evidence-Based Approach. And Todd, we've spent the last segment walking through some of what you found when you surveyed military members in terms of what they value, what they don't. So now what? Can DOD just take your report and run with it and design a pay system?
Well, we did this as a proof of concept. We wanted to prove that you could do this and you could get some pretty interesting results out of it. And you could use this type of an approach to actually inform future decisions about the military compensation system. So our recommendation out of this report is not to make any actual changes to the compensation system, but rather for DOD to do a full study like this of its own. And, you know, I freely admit in the report, we put this right up front, that, you know, we didn't have a true random sample in our survey like we really wanted. It wasn't as large of a sample as we wanted. We were short on some key demographic groups. We did not get nearly as many junior enlisted people as we wanted, and that's why throughout the report we never aggregate all of the survey responses together. We keep them filtered to just active duty personnel, and we keep them segmented by rank group or age group or other factors that we're looking at depending on the analysis.
And importantly, you couldn't require people to take the survey, whereas DOD could.
Yes, we're doing this as, you know, an outside organization. We did not have access to DOD's personnel databases, so we couldn't even, you know, blast an email out to 10,000 people in the military and say, please take our survey. DOD could at least do that, if not make people take the survey. You know, and so, you know, we were limited as an outsider about how, you know, what we could actually do in terms of getting a survey population. But DOD would not have those same limitations. But more importantly, DOD could actually link this kind of preference data that they get from people to other data in their personnel system. So they could look at, over time, you know, continue to run a survey like this year after year for people and see how their preferences match up with their actual actions. And so that's a big thing when you're analyzing this, is just because people say they prefer something, it doesn't necessarily mean it will improve their odds of staying in the service. But with, you know, if you continue to run a survey like this in DOD linked to the personnel system, you could track that and over time find that correlation between what preferences really determine whether or not a person chooses to stick around.
I think one of the really important things that comes through in your report is that people in the military value things differently based on what sort of demographic group they fall in, particularly by age. If you were to design a compensation system based on this kind of research and this kind of survey data, would you kind of have to break the traditional military compensation paradigm, which says we basically treat everyone equally, everyone gets the same pay as long as they're within the same rank and pay grade?
I think you would, and I think you'd want to. I think it makes good sense for a lot of reasons. It's a one-size-fits-all approach. Doesn't work very well in an all-volunteer force because you essentially have two different career tracks. You've got the short-term people you need to come in to serve a few years. And, you know, services like the Marine Corps and the Army in particular, they need lots of young people coming in all of the time. And then they need them to leave before they get old, you know, before they get like me and it takes them a few extra minutes to get out of bed in the morning. So they need that youth and vigor. They value it. And not everyone can progress through the military through a full career of 20 or 30 years and rise to the rank of general. It's just not the way it works. So you're always going to have that dual career system between the short-timers and the career people. I think you've got to have a compensation system that reflects that. You've got to have some types of pays and benefits that really target the short-term people. And, you know, those things are going to be, you know, really cash compensation, things that they give them cash up front. That's what they're going to value if they're a short-time person. But you can't just change your entire compensation system to focus on the short-term volunteers. You've also got to still have things in there that benefit the long-term career service people. So I think you've got to have a more segmented, more targeted compensation system. You could even go to something like a cafeteria-style plan where people can pick and choose on an individual basis what benefits they would like. And they can make the trade-offs using a tool like this in real time to say, well, you know what? You know, I've got a family now. My preferences are changing. Maybe I value this thing more than that thing now. And you let them do that.
That's interesting. I was going to ask about that because I was wondering about that. But if you go to an a la carte system for, say, commissaries, which you don't particularly like, okay, if I get a voucher to go to Safeway instead of, and I can't go to the commissary still has to keep its lights on. So you're not really saving any money there.
There are some types of benefits that they just wouldn't work, you know, in an a la carte system. It's either all or nothing. Either you have a commissary system and an exchange system or you don't. But other things like TRICARE for Life, if someone could opt out of that, if they want to, and instead of DOD setting aside $5,500 for that person for TRICARE for Life, they could give them some portion of that as an annual bonus. Let them do that. If they want to opt out of that system, fine. And the junior guys, they would be smart to opt out of it because it's highly unlikely they'll ever get that benefit.
Right. Todd Harrison is the Senior Fellow for Defense Budget Studies here at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. Todd, it's been a really interesting hour that just flew by. Thanks so much for doing this.
Well, thanks for having me.
And we will post Todd's report online at federalnewsradio.com. It's called Rebalancing Military Compensation, an Evidence-Based Approach. This is on DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this show or any of our past shows, visit us online where you can visit our full archive of episodes. I'm Jared Servais. So long.
You've been listening to On DOD with Federal News Radio DOD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. On DOD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.